love my baby, but my baby don't love nobody but me.
Ah, what a wonderful sting, how holy and utterly appropriate. When Scott Fitzgerald's masterpiece and everyone's favourite novel, The Great Gatsby, was released in 1925, initial reviews were lacklustre, well, to say the least. Words like melodramatic and superficial were deployed. As you know, set in the exclusive West Egg, which was really Great Neck on Long Island, Gatsby accurately reflected the mood of an era, the post-war, pre-Great Depression period of wild partying by the smart set of New York's jazz age, a term coined by Scott. And so he and his colourful wife, colourful being a well-chosen word, Zelda, were a central part of this culture. And ironically, this drinking, dancing, gambling, bootlegging all took place during the era of Prohibition, well, inevitably. However, Sarah, my next guest, argues that in The Great Gatsby, F. Scott Fitzgerald managed to grasp what others could not or would not see. He sensed that America was poised at the edge of great transformation, a period of turmoil and decline. And as I was listening for the umpteenth time to my audio book of the novel, as I hurtled through the darkness last night, I marvelled yet again at his amazing sort of insights into human character and motivation. And beyond that, a sense of, if you like, of physical or political context that's hinted at in a way that not even Jane Austen managed to do. Now, Sarah Churchill is Professor of American Literature and Public Understanding of the Humanities at the University of East Anglia, a fascinating name for a chair. And as Peter pointed out, she's also a 2014 Man Booker Prize judge. And she's written a wonderful biography of the book. And it's called, as we've already explained to you, Careless People, Murder, Mayhem, and the Invention of the Great Gatsby. And we welcome you to our little wireless program, Sarah.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be on the wireless. It's nice to be on the wireless today, which, as it happens, is Zelda Fitzgerald's 114th birthday. So she was born July 24th, 1900. So I think we should raise an imaginary glass.
Exactly. Absolutely. Oh, so much synchronicity in one program. Okay. Now, before the reviews came out, he confided to his editor that his book was about the best American novel ever written. Some of his friends might have disputed that, but he was on the money, I think.
I do too.
Why was he so confident?
Well, I think that he one of the things I talk about in the book was that he had an extraordinary intuition. He talked about it, particularly later in life, that his ability to guess right. And he had that intuition about his own work as well. And he just knew that he had done something that had never been done before, that he had captured a moment, but that he had done it in language that was timeless, and that he had written something extraordinary and beautiful, and yet that was full of insights and prescience, and that he had grabbed hold of something, and he just knew that he had, and he always had that confidence, even though, as you said, the novel was not particularly well reviewed when it came out. But he continued throughout his life to have faith, a Gatsby-esque faith, if you like, in the grandeur of what he had done. He wrote to his daughter just before he died in 1940 that it was a magnificent novel. So he always knew that, but nobody else around him seemed to see it.
It's interesting you talk about the longevity of the book, because Hemingway, his sort of friend, hasn't lasted as well as Fitzgerald, I think.
No, I agree. Although I think that it's also interesting that there are kind of trends and fashions, aren't there, in what we find interesting. And I, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, people were focusing on Hemingway and less interested in Fitzgerald. So these things are probably swings and roundabouts to a certain extent, and Hemingway may well yet, you know, live another day.
I've been pushing the barrow of another member of the triumvirate in Dos Passos. Happen to think USA is the great American novel, but... He's
I'm actually with you on that.
Taste.
Well, and Dos Passos is, of course, an important part of my story. I mean, he was a friend of Fitzgerald's. He was, and of Hemingway's. And as you say, he's perhaps the less known of the three now. But I quite agree with you. And Steinbeck owes an awful lot to Dos Passos' USA trilogy and Grapes of Wrath. And he's credited with innovating things that actually Dos Passos was the one who innovated. So I'm quite with you on that.
I'm very unhappy and have been very unhappy about the movie versions. Most recently, Baz Luhrmann, who's a young Australian, as you know. And I was one of, there's a wonderful moment in the novel where on his Baz's depictions of these orgies, which would have made Rome embarrassed, versus that sheet of text where Scott Fitzgerald writes the names of the people who attend the parties, and he can put them all on one sheet of paper. It reminds us how, in a way, the book has become ever inflated by interpretation.
Absolutely, and how it's become kind of literalized by interpretation as well. I mean, I agree with you that on the one hand, the parties in the Luhrmann film are sort of absurdly over the top. On the other hand, I find them strangely orchestrated. It's as if you're watching a show. You know, it's like he's directing, and they would have been much more chaotic and spontaneous than that. And that's something that I think Fitzgerald captures in his language as well. That this all of his parties, Gatsby's parties, are written about. The language that Fitzgerald uses is all implication, insinuation, hinting, suggestiveness. It is a profoundly suggestive novel. And Luhrmann, as is the case with other film and visual adaptations, seems to want to pin that down and reduce it and fix it to mean, you know, one thing or the other. I mean,
well,
the thing,
if ever there's a case of less is more, it is The Great Gatsby as a novel.
Indeed, and you know, I think we can all agree that that's probably not Luhrmann's long suit. It's not what he wants to do. I mean, he likes more is more, and that's fair enough. But it's not necessarily sympathetic to Fitzgerald's vision. And I think the other thing that's important for me about Luhrmann's vision of the party scenes is that he wants to celebrate them. And what that means to me is that actually the film that he produced is I think the film that Jay Gatsby would have made of his own life, but it's not the film that Scott Fitzgerald would have made. In other words, it doesn't have the darkness and the satire. Fitzgerald thought the parties were vulgar, and it's only the film adaptations progressively that have seen them as kind of purely romantic, but they weren't purely romantic in Fitzgerald's novel. They are a strange mix of romance and tawdriness. Luhrmann just seemed to want to glamorize them, in my opinion.
You jolt me back into an awareness that 1922 was a period before traffic lights, before commercial radio, and in a sense, before the popular singer. You know, New York was still lit mainly by gaslight.
Absolutely. And that's, of course, why there are ash heaps. The ash heaps come, coal fires. The ash heaps come between Long Island and Manhattan because they're the ashes from coal, which is what is primarily heating American homes. So we're in a transitional state from the Edwardian era to the modern era. And that's something that we have lost sight of. A lot of our images of Gatsby come actually from the late 1920s, things that happened after Fitzgerald published the novel, things that he hadn't even seen or imagined. For example, two quick examples that I talk about in my book. One is that we all picture the flappers in those quintessential flapper dresses that are knee length and therefore daring and you know, racy. But dresses in 1922 in America, as in England actually, were nearly ankle length. They were much closer to the length of 1918 than to the length of 1928. In other words, it's a more conservative and older era. And the other great image, iconic image that we all have of Gatsby is of all the guests dancing the Charleston. But the Charleston wasn't a dance craze until after the novel was published. And the word never appears in the novel for that very reason. Fitzgerald almost certainly had never heard of it or seen it.
Let's go back to the traffic lights, because I was convulsed with laughter on learning that the first traffic lights were not clearly understood. What did the green glass mean? So people would run reds and stop at green.
Well, I mean, that was one of the great, I'm glad you were convulsed with laughter, because I was as well when I found it. What I wanted to do was to try to ascertain whether of all the meanings of the green light. And of course, you know, I teach American literature. I myself as a student, you know, people sit around in seminars and debate the meaning of the green light. It's one of the most famous symbols in American literature. Does it mean envy? Does it mean spring? Does it mean rebirth? Does it mean the color of money? Which of course it means in America. And I would say it means all of those things. But one of the things I wanted then to find out was, could it have meant in Fitzgerald's mind, permission to go in the green light, you know, the traffic sense? And in order to know that, I just had to know whether that was a meaning that was available culturally at the time or whether we were anachronistically superimposing that back on it. And so I had to do a fair amount of research actually to find it. And it turns out, much to my delight, that New Yorkers were debating the meanings of green lights as Fitzgerald was writing the novel, just like all of us in our seminar classes, because they created these traffic lights, but they didn't have what they came to call traffic signal uniformity. In other words, they didn't use the lights consistently. So in some places, green seemed to mean stop, and in some places, green seemed to mean go, and red seemed to mean, you know, pause.
Free market forces.
Exactly. Like individualism.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things you do, which I think is a great help, is you reveal all the new terms that emerged. So we've got brand name, Hollywood, movie going, rough cut, robot, schlep, dimwit, multi-layered, mass market, transvestite, libidinal, post-Freudian, party crashing. Hello?
Yeah, sorry, just lost me there for a second. Yeah, I got you to party crashing.
I love all these terms. Yeah, at a time when America is being electrified, as you point out, there's an explosion of language.
Absolutely, and Virginia Woolf has a great observation about that, where she says that Americans in the early 1920s are doing what the Elizabethans did, that they're coining new language. And she says it doesn't take much to see that when you're coining new language, a new literature will emerge from it. One of the things that struck me about those words, I have a kind of long list of the words that emerged between 1928 and 1923, the period over which the action of Gatsby takes place. And one of the things that struck me also was how modern that language was. A lot of words that I thought were recent coinages are actually from the early 1920s. So the word post-feminist is first used in 1919, amazingly to me. The word subprime, I mean, I was writing this book as our crash was happening around us, and the word subprime was first used then as well. That words like wimp and cool first being used as a term of approval,
yeah. And
indeed wicked being used as a term of approval, and party being used as a verb. So I found it really amusing to think, you know, if you said, we partied last night and it was wicked, I think most of us would think that was 90s slang. But actually, you could have said that in the 1920s.
Now, one of the things that emerges from your researches is that again and again, Scott Fitzgerald is doing rip and tear. There's another term, piece of terminology. He's taking things from the newspapers. He's taking events and transmogrifying them, turning them into literature. Tell us about some of the things that were actually going on that might have been inspirational.
I mean, there was a great deal. I started to read through the papers because, as the example of the green light shows, what I was trying to do was to try to remove the layers of anachronism and myth and misconception that have accrued about the novel over time, and to go back to what meanings would have been available to Fitzgerald and his contemporaries to remember that it was a contemporary novel. And to do that, I went back to first principles and started reading newspapers and magazines to try to forget everything that I knew after 1925 and to only think about what he would have known when he was writing the novel. So I was doing it first in a spirit of research, and then, to my amazement, I kept turning up these details that echoed and corresponded with the novel itself, and came to feel that he was actually kind of, as you say, he was sort of transmuting and translating all of these contemporary details around him into the story. The one of the most interesting, which is the one that I spend the most time on in the book, for my money, was a real-life murder mystery that happened at the end of 1922, which of course is also the year in which Gatsby is set, and a minister and his lover were found murdered in a field in New Jersey, and it became headline news very quickly for lots of reasons, and a lot of the details in that case kind of find their way into Gatsby. And in particular, I came to feel that the female victim in the case was a dead ringer for Myrtle Wilson, and that her husband it was even more of a dead ringer for George Wilson, Myrtle's husband. Fitzgerald uses language to describe George Wilson in The Great Gatsby that is almost verbatim the language that the newspapers used to describe the victim's husband, who was a man named James Mills. And I gave that story a fair amount of prominence in my book for a couple of reasons. I ended up, you said that it was as I say, my book is a kind of biography of Gatsby. But as I wrote it, it also became, I realized it was becoming a kind of nonfiction parallel to it, a kind of nonfiction version of it. And so I used Hall Mills, the murder is called the Hall Mills murder, and I used it as a kind of parallel version of the Tom and Myrtle story, but one that was historically true. So Fitzgerald gives about 20% of Gatsby to the Tom and Myrtle story, so I gave about 20% of my book to the Hall Mills story, but I also did that because I thought it was a story that was amazing in its own right. I mean, it is macabre and hilarious in a sort of grotesque and awful way, in a kind of farcical, dark, you know, black comedy. And so I thought it was sort of an amazing story. But what I thought it also did was point up the darkness and the chaos of life in America in the early 1920s, because as we said a moment ago, we have tended very much to romanticize and glamorize the era, but it was a dark and a brutal era as well, and that is part of what Gatsby is about. It's a darker novel than we tend to remember, I think, a tawdrier novel, and that's, I mean, it's a novel about tawdriness. It's not itself tawdry, but it's creating a tawdry reality. And that for me was what this murder kind of, I hoped it would remind people of that or bring it back to life.
Well, I think the clumsy interpretations of the novel that were particularly cinematic ones, can be extrapolated into that terrible, I think, Scorsese film, The Wolf of Wall Street, which has no sort of moral center at all. It just sort of wallows in what it ostensibly criticizing. Whereas what Scott Fitzgerald is doing all the time is being, in fact, almost godlike, you know, looking down on these people, not with cruel judgment and with a fair degree of compassion, but with a high sense of morality. It is a very moral book.
Absolutely. He was a moralist, and he would be delighted to hear you say that. I think he would have been horrified at anybody not seeing that this is, as you say, a novel with a very clear moral center. And the you mentioned that he kind of stands in judgment, and of course it is I agree with that, and of course it's a novel in which it opens with Nick Carraway eschewing judgment, claiming that he reserves all judgment. And one way of reading the novel would be to say that it is the story of Nick Carraway's lesson that judgments must be made, that we can't go through life not making judgments, that we have to make certain kinds of distinctions and moral distinctions, and that these are incredibly important. And I agree with you. I think the way that Scorsese was enjoying what the film kind of pretended to criticize is, again, you know, kind of takes us back to Lerman, that what is great about the novel is the way in which it is ambiguous, but it's about ambivalence. It's about the fact that we crave beauty and luxury, and yet Fitzgerald recognized that was corrupt, that is a corrupt desire and would corrupt us.
We've talked about our shared interest in Dos Passos and Hemingway, but as we talk, I suddenly think more and more that the book that it most reminds me of is Pride and Prejudice of Jane Austen, you know, where she's, because both writers see the people with such total and absolute clarity and have towards them a sort of a, well, it is that she both are judgmental, but both are also, in a way, the most delicious satirists.
Absolutely. It is such a satirical novel, and I think you're absolutely, it is a social satire. And to go back to the point that you made when we started about the degree to which its contemporary readers didn't appreciate it, part of that was because it was so clearly for them a contemporary satire that was all they could see. And so they thought that it would date instantly. They thought that it was just a story of the summer because it was satirizing their world so clearly and so sharply. They also thought that because until Gadsby, Fitzgerald was primarily known as a satirist. He is a much funnier writer than we think, again, because of that image of romance and glamour that we have. It tends to overwrite. I'm not saying that he's not a romantic and glamorous writer, but rather that that tends to overwrite everything else that he also is. And I just would say about the Jane Austen comparison, I think you're absolutely right. It's one I've made myself. And I think that where, you know, Austen famously writes comedies of manners, I would just say that Gatsby is a tragedy of manners.
Yeah.
You know, it's about the tragic consequences of that world, but he absolutely has an Austenian sense of the hilarities of it as well.
Well, both of us would reject Hemingway's swipe at him in the Cenosa Kilimanjaro, referring to him as poor Scott Fitzgerald, pathetically defined by his romantic awe of the rich. I don't see romantic awe of the rich for a moment.
No, not at all. It's an excoriation of the rich. He calls them careless. And you know that, and that's where the title of my book comes from. He says Tom and Daisy were careless people and they destroy lives and then they walk away. And there is no romantic awe of the rich there. It is a novel in which the rich are the bad guys, or the, you know, old money are the bad guys. And Fitzgerald was very, very angry at Hemingway for saying that. In fact, he wrote Hemingway a very sharp letter saying, "I have never been fascinated by mere wealth. I am only fascinated by interesting people, and some of them, you know, they may have the trappings of wealth, or wealth may enable them to do things." He did studies of what wealth did to people. The next major work that he wrote after The Great Gatsby is a story called The Rich Boy, which is where Hemingway gets that quotation from, where he says that the rich are different from you and me. But Fitzgerald in The Rich Boy is writing a study of the corrupting power of wealth. It is about how growing up rich destroys you. So what he's saying is that he says the rich are different because they have grown up under different circumstances. He's making a socially anthropological observation, which I think is true. The other thing about that Hemingway story that briefly is worth saying, because it's an urban myth that has made the rounds. People think that line from Kilimanjaro was Hemingway's riposte to Fitzgerald. That line, the only thing that's different about the rich is that they have more money. But in fact, in point of historical fact, it was Hemingway who, at a dinner at which Scott Fitzgerald was not even present, said, "I'm getting to know the rich." And an Irish writer and critic named Mary Colum said to Hemingway, "The rich are no different from you and me, they only have more money." Mm-hmm. Hemingway took that line that had been used to shoot him down and humiliate him in public and used it against Scott Fitzgerald, who hadn't even been present at the time in his story. So I always try to defend Scott when that story comes up.
Sarah, how did he handle money himself? Now, his career has some extraordinary ups and downs, but in due course, he becomes a very successful, financially successful writer. Does he handle it well, or is he...
Yeah, having just said that I'll defend Scott, I think it would be foolish to try to defend his business sense. He and Zelda were both very profligate. He did earn very well, particularly at the beginning of his career, for the 20s, from 1920 when he broke out with his first novel, This Side of Paradise, through 1929 and 1930, through the crash, basically. He was one of America's highest paid writers, and he made a great deal of money, and they ran through it almost instantly. They lived very much beyond their means. That said, they were also very young. I mean, we mentioned at the beginning that Zelda was born in 1900. In other words, when they got married and started partying, she was only 20 years old and he was 24. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, I know a fair number of 20 and 24-year-olds who aren't great with money either, especially if they get an awful lot of it. Once the crash happened, Fitzgerald's literary fortunes took a very sudden nosedive, and for the last decade of his life, he actually didn't have very much money at all. He was in debt, and Zelda was ill, as I'm sure your listeners know. She had a very serious mental breakdown, and so he had to pay for her hospitalization costs. He wanted her to have, obviously, the finest medical care, and for their daughter's education, because with all the difficulties they were both having, they sent their daughter to boarding school and then to university, and suddenly he found himself not able to pay for those kinds of necessities, although granted, as I say, he wanted the finest of those necessities, but he was really struggling for the last decade to even make ends meet, and he died more or less a pauper, I mean, you know, in real terms.
With, as I recall, a rather poorly attended funeral.
It was. He had, again, one of these moments of uncanny prescience. His funeral echoed Jay Gatsby's funeral, which he had imagined 15 years earlier, to a really extraordinary degree. It was raining, and there were only kind of 20 people there, 20 or 30 people. Zelda wasn't able to come because her doctors judged that it would have been too dangerous for her. She had a breakdown when she heard the news. And Fitzgerald's daughter later told the story, which hasn't been much reported and which I found absolutely astonishing, that he, you know, Scott Fitzgerald was Catholic, but he wasn't, he didn't die, he was a lapsed Catholic, and so he wasn't buried in a Catholic burial. He had an Episcopal minister. And this Episcopal minister took the extraordinary decision, in his, you know, during the funeral service, to say that Fitzgerald was a no good drunken bum, and that the only reason he'd agreed to take on the service was because he wanted to put him in the ground. I mean, and you can't imagine anybody saying such a thing. I mean, yeah. It's just extraordinary. And I found it amazing that that story didn't get more traction, because that seems to me one of the more, you know, outrageous things I've ever heard in my life.
You tell me that post-feminist is a term from the 20s. Can we now, in as we wind up, can I ask you, how well do you think you wrote Daisy?
That's a good question. I think that Daisy is, I think he wrote her very well in technically, in the sense that what he wanted, as with Gatsby, was he wanted somebody who was an idea more than a person. And so, in fact, all the characters, except for Nick, you could say that about. They're gestures. Daisy is a low voice, and, you know, she's just got this magical voice. She has hair that is different colors at different times in the book. Sometimes it's yellow, sometimes it's dark. And she's a symbol. And she's a symbol of what Gatsby desires. She's a symbol of wealth. She's a symbol of inclusiveness, of, you know, being, you know, getting it right and being in the in crowd and all of the things that Gatsby desires. Some people have faulted Fitzgerald for writing a female character who was only a symbol. But, of course, she's also a symbol to Gatsby. I mean, we can say that that's Gatsby's failure rather than Fitzgerald's, that he never sees her as a human being. He certainly can't see her flaws. So what I would say is that Fitzgerald very accurately captures the way, the power structures of sexual politics in the early 1920s, and we can debate whether and to what degree he was able to escape those himself.
It's lovely to talk to someone who shares, not any of my enthusiasm, but I'm sure that of a great many of your listeners here, because, as I said, it's almost everyone's favourite novel. You've done it proud, Sarah. Sarah Churchwell, author of Careless People, Murder, Mayhem, and the Invention of the Great Gatsby, published by Virago Books. Sarah, thank you. And thank you to the team, Stan Corry, Penny Lomax, Mudita Diaz, Gab Sario, and technical operators Lila Schooner and Marty Peralta. And thank you, Mike, for helping me up here in Muswellbrook. That's pretty much your lot for now. Have a lovely weekend, and I'll talk to you next week.